From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Governor Ron DeSantis signed Florida's new state budget earlier this week, but left out of it was federal money that he says shouldn't have been there in the first place.
They said you can't use it for the purpose that we wanted to use it for, to create a fund to meet needs in the future.
Also this week, on the very first day of Pride Month, the governor signs into law a bill banning transgender women and girls from competing in female school sports.
On the first day that we should be celebrating our identity as a community is something that we will not forget.
We'll also get a feel for how Florida school kids are receiving some catch-up help coming out of the COVID chaos, and we'll learn how the city of Key West lost the power to control its own seaport. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Since the regular 2021 Florida lawmaking session ended just over a month ago, the trickle of bills coming to Governor Ron DeSantis' desk went from a trickle to a flood, and the most important bill of them all got the governor's signature this week. DeSantis approved the largest budget ever for the upcoming fiscal year. It was the first in state history to hit the $100 billion mark. But as it came from the legislature, it was even larger. DeSantis chopped $1.5 billion from the budget before gracing the document with his signature. Blaise Gainey talks about the projects that wound up on the chopping block, as well as those that got the green light from the governor.
This year's spending plan includes an increase to minimum wage for state workers from $8.65 to $13 an hour, as well as bonuses for teachers, principals, and first responders. The budget also funds several projects across the state. In North Florida, Senator Loran Ausley says she is thankful that the smaller counties she serves were able to receive funding they've needed for years.
Calhoun County received $19 million in special facilities funding to start rebuilding their schools after Hurricane Michael, which is desperately needed.
Other projects funded include the Gaston County Mobile Health Unit, as well as a new fire truck for Liberty County. DeSantis also gave $500,000 to Tallahassee Community College. President Jim Murdahl says it'll help them expand upon their current nursing program.
One of the things that I'm particularly happy about is that we were able to get a $500,000 appropriation that the governor approved that will allow us to purchase some much-needed equipment for our nursing expansion.
But not everyone received the funding they were expecting. In the Tampa Bay region, DeSantis vetoed funding for over 20 initiatives. That includes $400,000 for Feeding Tampa Bay's Workforce Development Program. The Tampa nonprofit trains people who can't find jobs by helping them earn certifications in fields like transportation, warehouse work, and culinary arts. Organization President and CEO Thomas Mance says the program is important for helping people now and in the future.
When someone comes to you for a meal, they've got other economic challenges in their lives. And one of our fundamental precepts is, how do we take someone that comes in for a meal? How do they walk out with a future?
DeSantis is praising the $100 billion budget and credits much of it to his decision to keep businesses and schools open. When speaking on the $1.5 billion in cuts, DeSantis says most of that was federal money that was nixed because of constraints on how the state could spend the dollars.
They said you can't use it for the purpose that we wanted to use it for, to create a fund to meet needs in the future. And so because of that, if we were to go forward with it, we were going to run into risk of having the feds come after us for it. We also functionally just wouldn't have been able to use it effectively.
DeSantis also cited concerns about a federal procurement process that could slow the state down in an emergency. Much of the veto dollars went to create a $1 billion emergency response fund. I'm Blaise Gainey.
LGBTQ advocates are condemning Governor Ron DeSantis' decision to sign into law a bill that bans transgender women and girls from competing on female sports teams. Robbie Gaffney reports the signing took place on the first day of Pride Month.
This is not a coincidence. To entirely disregard and devalue our community on the first day that we should be celebrating our identity as a community is something that we will not forget.
That's Alfonso David with the Human Rights Campaign. His organization plans to challenge the law that would force transgender women and girls to play on male sports teams.
The naysayers are going to lose this battle. They have fought us for decades, and they have lost, and they will continue to lose.
Lakeland Republican Senator Kelly Stargell helped push the bill forward last session. She says the new law isn't meant to be discriminatory.
This bill is very simply about making sure that women can safely compete, have opportunities, and physically be able to excel in a sport that they've trained for, prepared for, and worked for.
Supporters of the new law say it's needed because transgender women could have a competitive advantage in sports. They often point to a pair of transgender women in Connecticut who beat their cisgender counterparts in high school track team competitions. Both those women are Black, and David says the reasoning for the ban is not only rooted in transphobia, but also racism.
The images that proponents of these bills most often use are Black trans women and girls. Black girls and women have had their bodies constantly policed in athletics and beyond, and these bills are another hateful take.
A federal judge dismissed a lawsuit that would have stopped the two transgender women in Connecticut from competing in female sports. Since 2013, 11 transgender students have applied for and been approved to play on the team that aligns with their gender identity in Florida. Winter Park Democratic Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith says those students have been able to compete without incident.
They couldn't find, and as they were repeatedly asked to do, proponents of the bill could not find a single incident or issue that came up as a result of that 2013 policy.
Megan Titcomb is the mother of a transgender girl. She says conversations at the dinner table have been hard since the bill has been taken up by lawmakers.
It's just not fair. It's hard as a parent to tell your kid, I'm sorry, honey, you can't play, but I can't explain why. And there's nothing I can do about it other than move out of the state. And I know a lot of parents in a lot of other states fighting similar issues, and we can't all just keep moving around, hoping to find a better life for our kids. Like, that's not the answer.
Titcomb says protections are going to have to come down from a national level to protect transgender kids. 7 other states have passed similar laws to Florida's transgender sports ban. I'm Robbie Gaffney.
Florida lawmakers have put an end to fighting over how much to invest into affordable housing. Governor Ron DeSantis signed legislation this week that guarantees all the money in the state and local affordable trust funds for affordable housing will pay for programs that help those on the verge of homelessness. At the same time, the legislature permanently cut in half the revenues flowing into those funds. As Valerie Crowder tells us, affordable housing advocates are torn on the deal.
Governor Ron DeSantis initially proposed investing all of the $423 million in the state and local affordable housing trust funds into programs that help keep people from ending up homeless. But Republican legislative leadership cut the distribution of revenues that flow into the funds this session, leaving $209 million available for housing assistance.
Obviously, we wish they would have picked a different source, but that's the one they picked. So at the end of the day, they did appropriate all the money that was going to be in the housing trust funds. They just changed the doc stamp distribution so that that amount is less than it would have been.
That's Mark Hendrickson with an organization that advocates for full funding of housing programs called the Sadowski Coalition. Lawmakers created the state and local affordable housing trust funds in 1992 through legislation called the Sadowski Act. Money from the state's documentary stamp tax revenues made up those funds. But the 1992 law contained no guarantee that the legislature would allocate those dollars to affordable housing programs. As a result, lawmakers have repeatedly swept away money from those funds to pay for other items in the budget for more than a decade.
The Sadowski Act worked off the assumption that if the legislature created a trust fund and funded it, that it would kind of went without saying that we thought they would appropriate it. Over time, that turned out not to be the case.
Though they permanently cut the affordable housing trust funds, the legislature passed a bill that guarantees lawmakers will stop spending those dollars elsewhere. Hendrickson says the guaranteed into the sweeps will ensure money in the state and local affordable housing trust funds only pays for housing programs and will allow for longer range planning.
Even though the amount of money is less than what in theory could have gone to housing, local governments and the development community can both have a pretty good idea of what is going to be going to housing each year for the foreseeable future. We may actually end up with more money in housing, not than we theoretically could have had, but that we really would have gotten given the legislature's, routine sweeping of the trust funds.
About $146 million is in the local Affordable Housing Trust Fund for the State Housing Initiative's Partnership Program, also known as SHIP. Every county in the state and some cities will receive SHIP dollars to distribute in their communities for emergency home repairs and rental and mortgage payment assistance. Trey Price leads the Florida Housing Finance Corporation, which oversees the program. Price says this year the program is getting a lot more from the state than last year when there were no dollars allocated. He says they relied on federal funds instead.
Turns out that, you know, we've done pretty well, and we also backfilled that money with federal resources from the CARES Act.
About $60 million in the State Affordable Housing Trust Fund will finance the State Apartment Incentive Loan Program through the next year. That program finances loans for developers to build affordable housing units. Governor Ron DeSantis vetoed the legislature's attempt to move $40 million out of that fund, meaning that money will remain there for appropriation. Price says lawmakers could spend that money on the sale program during the off session later this year, or they could wait until they're crafting next year's budget.
It'll be just around the corner when that money will be ready to be appropriated for housing in the following budget.
Not everyone is satisfied with trading a permanent cut to the Affordable Housing Trust Funds for a guaranteed end to the sweeps. Zalayla Adeferis is with the progressive advocacy group Florida Housing Justice Alliance. Adeferis lives in Miami-Dade County. She says a disproportionate amount of people who live there are in need of affordable housing, meaning they spend more than 30% of their income on rent or mortgage payments.
When I moved to Miami, I spent 50% of my income on housing, for example, on a studio apartment. So it's a huge deal. It's a huge issue that a lot of what's being built are luxury condos, especially because we're in a tourist area like so many areas of the state. And we don't really see affordable housing, you know, prioritized by developers and by the real estate market.
The roughly $400 million that were in the trust funds before the legislature cut those dollars in half would have covered the state's affordable housing needs. Adeferis says the state had plenty of money to keep the funds intact and guarantee an end to the sweeps.
It's coming from South Florida that the issue is so critical. We need like all the help we can get from the state. And so it's kind of like a consolation. That's how it feels to me. Politics is politics, so I guess they'll do whatever they do, but it's just really sad seeing the need every single day here in our community and knowing that there was actually a solution in place that was disregarded year after year after year, and now there is this guarantee, but it's half of what what should have been there, honestly.
The more than $200 million state lawmakers permanently swept away from the Affordable Housing Trust Funds will pay for environmental projects across the state. I'm Valerie Crowder.
It's been more than a year since the COVID-19 pandemic shuttered schools and forced kids out of classrooms and into online learning. The sudden closure and extended online experience has raised concerns about learning loss and kids falling behind in their studies. That concern spurred Florida to reopen its schools, giving families the option of sending students back to in-person classes. And many families took that option. Now, as Lynn Hatter reports, schools are prepping for more intensive summer programs and reflecting on a school year unlike any other.
Baker County school teacher Angela Callahan says the shutdowns last spring had a devastating toll on her youngest son.
He was a vibrant first grader last March, but came back to school in August as a shy and anxious second grader. The first time his teacher called on him, he hid under his desk, getting emotional, and he refused to speak for days.
Being at home for 5 months, says Callahan, took away her son's confidence.
He regressed socially and academically. My child needed to be in his classroom with his peers, with his teachers. All of our children needed to be in their classrooms with their peers and their teachers.
Callahan shared her story during a recent press conference alongside Governor Ron DeSantis, who was touting pay raises for teachers and principals. 94% of Baker County's students returned to in-person classes last August. That's one of the highest percentages in the state. The return was possible because DeSantis and State Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran mandated districts provide an in-person option. And it's a decision DeSantis says was the right one.
Had we closed the schoolhouse doors, had we not let the kids in, the damage that that would have done, you could be the best teacher in the world, the best principal in the world, the best superintendent in the world. I don't think we would have been able to recover from that. And you're going to see lasting damage in other parts of the country for people who didn't do the right thing.
Districts across the state are breathing sighs of relief after completing a full school year in a pandemic. But they're not resting. Many students will still be going to school in the summer months as districts offer more summer programs to kids who may have fallen behind. Leon County Schools' Jillian Gregory says her district's summer programs are being funded through federal relief money. Leon Schools plans to offer several programs to elementary, middle, and high schoolers. The abrupt closure of schools last spring and uncertainty about whether they'd reopen led to concerns about learning loss and students falling behind. But in Florida, many of those fears haven't panned out to the extent first believed.
I think that is a fair statement, because I think you have places like Chicago, California, New York, where students were out for much of the year, if not the whole year. And so for example, New York is just talking about reopening and for all in-person learning next fall. We have offered in-person learning to our families since August. And so many of our families have taken us up on it, particularly, a variety of families have taken us up on it.
Just because students were in school doesn't mean those classrooms were insulated from the virus. And even though many schools took precautions, students and their teachers still missed some days due to contracting the virus or being exposed to it. The end of the year, Gregory says, is a milestone.
We've had probably a solid 15, 16 months of cortisol running through our system. And so for everyone to, on the last day of school, to celebrate in whatever way their family does, and just to take a minute to be together and to high five that we've made it through.
It will be a summer of recharge for some and catch up for others. I'm Len Hatter.
Before and throughout this year's legislative session, WLRN in Miami has been following the accelerating effort by state lawmakers to strip various powers from Florida counties and cities. It seems that one of the bills passed this year to keep localities from having any kind of authority over the cruise ship industry wound up impacting just one place. WLRN's Nancy Klinginger delved deeply into the issue, and here's the resulting podcast.
If more than 80% of voters in your city decide to do something, and the state decides, nah, we're not going to let you do that, then do those voters actually have any power at all? It's the tree falls in the forest question of the political moment.
If the state wants to run everything, why do we have a local government? Why are we here?
We're going to go down, all the way down, to Key West. Key West is more than 600 miles from Tallahassee with only 25,000 residents. But it keeps winding up as a target of politics in the state capital. The Florida legislature just overturned an overwhelmingly popular section of the city charter. It's the latest part of a long debate over the role of cruise ships in Key West. Nancy Klinginger covers the Keys for WLRN. Nan, what's going on in Key West?
So last November, voters in Key West approved new limits on the cruise industry that would cut it way back. And everyone expected that to be challenged in court. But instead, it came up in the legislature in Tallahassee.
We can't simply have a group of 10,000 people closing down the port of Key West and also saying a million people a year cannot visit the state of Florida and Key West. That's wrong.
That's Spencer Roach. He's a state representative from Lee County.
So Roach is essentially saying the people of Key West don't have any say in this, but it is a municipal port literally owned by the people of Key West. So that seems like an important point in this discussion.
Yeah, and Spencer Roach initially introduced a bill that would have applied to all the deepwater ports in the state of Florida that said they could not regulate cruise ships, essentially. And a lot of the ports, like the big ones, Port of Miami, Port Everglades, really didn't like that. The Ports Council came out publicly against it. So they narrowed it down so it only applied to municipal ports, ports that are run by cities, and there's only four of those in the state. But the other three of them were also unhappy about it. Here's a lobbyist from St. Petersburg talking at one of the hearings on that bill.
City of St. Pete, simple message, just let us out of the bill. We don't know where this came from. They don't do cruise ships now, but they may in the future. They just really don't want to be captured in this particular situation, which is really a fight in Key West.
They narrowed that bill down even further, so it only applied to ports that are adjacent to an area of critical state concern, and there's only four of those in the state, and one of them is the Keys. So the bill really only applied to Key West. Cruise ships have been coming to Key West for decades and decades, going back at least to the 80s and maybe longer. But the numbers really picked up in the 90s, and those numbers have varied a lot over the years, but gotten pretty high. In 2019, almost a million people came to Key West by cruise ship. And there's a long history of conflict about that. I talked to Tony Falcone. He opened a store in Key West in 1976 called Fast Buck Freddy's, and it was a real landmark on Duval Street.
As more and more cruise ships came in, there was a definite change to the retailing on Duval Street. To the point that in the mid-90s, late 90s, there were 96 t-shirt shops on the first eight blocks of Duval Street.
Falcone says the locals and the tourists who want to feel like locals stopped going to Duval.
Instead of having an enjoyable day shopping, getting something, some lunch at a restaurant, they felt as if they were just battling hordes of people. And people would tell me this and apologize that they supported us for 20 years, but they weren't going to come down anymore.
Fast Bucks closed in 2012.
So it sounds like the character of Key West started to change parallel to the arrival of these big cruise ships.
Yeah, and the mayor of Key West, Terry Johnston, she says that's what's really at stake here. And that's what makes her so mad about this bill, where the legislature is basically making a decision about the character of Key West.
Here's what they don't get. They don't get people come to Key West because we are a community. I mean, they come to Key West and they love the same things that locals love. They love, you know, you can turn a corner in a residential neighborhood and you find this little restaurant that no one knows about. And everything that we're seeing, that we're finding right now, is working to erode that community fiber.
Is community character the only thing people are worried about with cruise ships?
A lot of people thought cruise ships caused real problems for the environment, especially around Key West Harbor. I talked to Will Benson. He's a fishing guide who grew up in the Keys, and he said Key West is in a really important place for fish, right at the intersection of the Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico.
So there's a lot of current, there's a lot of sea life, there's a lot of critters, because, you know, a lot of our critters, you know, either winter or summer in the Gulf, and then they move out to the reef to go spawn. And they used those channels as kind of, you know, superhighways of sorts. And, you know, the port of Key West happens to exist right in one of those thoroughfares.
The area around Key West Harbor is especially important for tarpon, which are those big silverfish that kind of look like submarines. And they're really important for fishing guides like Benson. And he says the cruise ships have a big impact on that.
Every time they come through, you know, they push the tarpon out of the way. They kind of immediately roll through and disturb everything. But then they leave basically a trail of bleeding seafloor behind them. It makes the bottom of that channel like a blasted moonscape.
That podcast featuring reporter Nancy Klinginger was produced by WLRN in Miami. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Florida certainly has its own share of endangered animals. The state's iconic panthers and manatees spring most quickly to mind, but the state's hospitable climate also makes Florida an ideal refuge for creatures from many other lands. Gina Jordan traveled to just such a refuge to interact with some of those animals and wound up with an earful.
Did you know you can pet one of the world's most endangered mammals just half an hour from Tallahassee?
Oh my goodness, boys. Yeah? This is going to be very loud, just so you know.
Okay. That's Ryan David Raines, executive director and founder of the North Florida Wildlife Center. The center sits on about 10 acres just outside the Jefferson County town of Lamont. We were standing in the lemur habitat when the two occupants got very excited.
I'm so glad you calmly said this is going to get loud.
They, black and white ruffed lemurs, or ruffed lemurs in general, are the second loudest primates on Earth.
Rains is an FSU grad from Miami Beach. He chose this rural location almost 2 years ago because it was spacious and affordable. The nonprofit center is dedicated to wildlife conservation through education, fieldwork, and breeding programs. Funding comes from donations and customers. The public is welcome for tours and hands-on encounters with exotic animals. You can even hang out with these loud but very soft lemurs with cool names.
Saka and Akundru, meaning cat and banana, respectively, in Malagasy, which is the native language of Madagascar.
A nearby common brown lemur named Tiana watches as the guys climb into a box full of cilantro, chives, and berries. Their white fur turns purple as they roll around in berry juice.
Instead of throwing their food in a bowl, you put it in a cardboard box, close it up, and, you know, when they're done with the box, they can play with it. It still smells like fruit. It's an incredibly simple way to keep our animals entertained. It's very easy and part of our enrichment program.
Saka and Akundru are part of a breeding program, but no matches have been found for them yet. They came to the center from a lemur sanctuary in Central Florida, and Tiana arrived from a similar sanctuary in South Florida. Lemurs are critically endangered. Madagascar is the only place they can be found in the wild. And it turns out the North Florida Wildlife Center has a Tallahassee connection in that island country near East Africa.
Thomasville Road Kid is now in Madagascar, regrowing rainforests, and, you know, went there via working on Wall Street for 15 years. So, yeah, so I'm kind of like the hometown kid that ended up 28,000 kilometers away.
Matt Hill grew up in Tallahassee. His dad was a math professor at Florida A&M University and overseas.
People say, wow, that must be really weird going out to the middle of nowhere, rainforest Madagascar. And I go, you know, the swamps I grew up in North Florida, playing and riding my bike and hanging out and making tree forts, is, you know, it's a different world, of course. It's Africa.
Back in Lamont, a habitat expansion is underway for the Wildlife Center's more than 40 residents, with plans for a grand opening of the aviary complex in the fall. Now that the pandemic is waning, Rains is ready to restart some off-site programs, including visits to summer camps.
There is nowhere really between, say, Jacksonville and Panama City that is open to the public in this way, that keeps incredible animals like this. So we have lots of local species here, from monarchs to our rescue pelicans to our rescue barred owls, but also non-native species, like, for instance, our kangaroos or our vine snakes or our mud skippers or lemurs. So it's really a unique facility, and, you know, we're becoming a huge part of the community, and we're very thankful for that.
The center is open to the public, but reservations are required. Find more information about Green Again and the North Florida Wildlife Center at WFSU.org. I'm Gina Jordan.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Valerie Crowder, Robbie Gaffney, Blaze Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Nancy Klinginger. Technical assistance for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.